Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to All of It. Seems hard to believe, but the 2018 midterm elections are finally over. Democrats have taken back the House. Republicans built on their numerical advantage in the Senate. And we're looking at 2 years of divided government. It was an intense campaign, particularly for a midterm. And here we are. I'm joined now by WNYC's Kai Wright. Hi, Kai.
Hi.
He's the host of WNYC's Studios podcast, The United States of Anxiety. WNYC's New Jersey editor, Nancy Solomon, is here. Hi, Nancy.
Hello.
And Larry Levy, executive dean of the National Center for Suburban Studies at Hofstra, is here as well. Hi, Larry.
How you doing?
All right. If you played the drinking game where you had to drink every time you said flip last night, you have a pretty bad hangover this morning, I think. So, Larry, we'll start with you. We talked to you about this last week. There was a narrative leading up to this election that the burbs in New York and New Jersey were going to play a vital role in deciding who controls the House for the next 2 years. How much of a role did the burbs actually play?
Well, you could call this the revolt of the suburbs, or the suburbs ate the Republican Party, whatever is your favorite movie title. President Trump and candidate Trump never did very well in the suburbs to begin with. You have this idea of demographic destiny, where many suburbs, not just in our area, but around the country, are changing dramatically. Literally, the face of those communities is changing with a surge of new immigrants and other minorities, and they're bringing their Democratic voting tendencies with them. So this was going to happen in 2, 4, 6, 10 years anyways, just because of population shifts. But it happened a bit faster last night.
Nancy, last week on the show, I made you promise to come back because you'd made some predictions. You said that suburban women of New Jersey were fired up and ready to go election day. I know you spent a lot of time on the ground yesterday talking to voters. How much of a role did suburban women play?
A huge role.
Okay,
I think
pat yourself on the back. Reach around.
I feel vindicated, just in the sense that I've been talking about what I was seeing going on in the New Jersey suburbs for almost 2 years. I mean, it started back in January around the time of the Women's March and the inauguration. And I've been saying, hey, you know, this is really different. And I was hearing back from, especially Republicans and Republican, strategists that, there is no way, Republicans are going to lose these districts. And let's remember, these districts were gerrymandered to protect incumbents. And what we saw yesterday is three of these seats are flipped for sure. One is hanging on by a thread. So there is possibly only one, and best case, only two Republicans out of the five left in New Jersey. And the swing in the 11th Congressional District and the 7th Congressional District, where Rodney Frelinghuysen and Leonard Lance were winning by, 60% mm-hmm. for years. And then you see Mikey Sherrill win by, I don't have the number in front of me, but it's big. It's 56-57%. So this is big. I think there's one interesting thing, though, to compare is the what we see in the New Jersey suburbs versus rural New Jersey. And, Seth Grossman, Republican candidate down in the southernmost region of New Jersey, the 2nd Congressional District. I mean, this is a guy who was disowned by the National Republican Party. That's kind of how off the books, mm-hmm. Saying stuff about people of color and immigrants and the offensive things. So he actually performed pretty well down there. He lost, and Jeff Van Drew will be the new Democratic congressman down there, but he came kind of close. And so you see that what's going on around the country happening in a microcosm in New Jersey, where you have these suburban districts that are really changing a lot, and not just because of white women voters that we've been talking about a lot, but also because there are a lot of people of color who now live in the suburbs, and these suburbs have slowly opened up and become more diverse. So I think that's a factor as well. And then you have these rural areas that are still pretty dug in conservative, pro-Trump.
Feels like when you describe it, almost feels like you're describing Virginia. What's Virginia's become? Mm-hmm. That same kind of thing.
Very similar. And I think we saw very similar results in Virginia last night as to New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Very, very similar.
So, Kai, was it a blue wave or wasn't it a blue wave.
It builds on what Nancy just got just described. I mean, and it's true all over the country. I think what the real story, there's a lot of conversation about whether the Democrats, you know, where they swung left, where they stayed center. The real story is that the Democratic, two things happened. Democratic Party ran appropriate appropriate candidates grew up out of primaries in for the right districts. So right in some of these suburban places, you had a candidate like Mikey Sherrill grow up out of the district who is an appropriate candidate for that district. It's majority white and it is moderate, and you have a moderate white woman who won.
When you're saying appropriate, do you mean winnable?
No, I mean that reflect the district. You know, that they didn't nationalize the races, that they were actually local races. And sometimes with the party support and sometimes over the top of what the party wanted. And so there's some places where you just saw that, where you just saw a candidate that actually reflected what that district wanted. And that's one trend. And the other trend is that you saw districts that where Democrats for the first time ran meaningful campaigns that expanded who's voting there and expanded the playing field there. And that's where you see that in a lot of places in the South. That's the story of Georgia. That was the story of Texas. That is a story of some of these of some of the, I wouldn't call them unexpected, but we're treating them as unexpected victories of diverse candidates when we start talking about the two Latinas who won in Texas, two Native women who won out west, in Michigan and Minnesota, having the first two Muslim women in Congress. So I think those are really the two narratives. You see Democrats allowing local elections to be local elections and candidates reflecting their districts. And then you see this expanding electorate in places, and sometimes in the suburbs and sometimes that are statewide.
I'm going to be Debbie Downer about the diversity aspect, though. We still do not have a black governor in the United States of America. We had the chance to possibly have two. Stacey Abrams in Georgia and Andrew Gillum in Florida.
Well, let's also be clear. I'll challenge your opening statement that the midterms are over. They are not quite over, sadly. And that is not a foregone conclusion either. It is the currently it looks like that is going to remain true, that Brian Kemp is going to be governor of Georgia. But it was my prediction going into this. It remains my prediction that this race will be settled in court. There is an 85,000 vote difference the last time I looked. According to the Abrams campaign, we don't have the official numbers because Brian Kemp is the Secretary of State. And so we have not heard from the Secretary of State's office the details of the vote count. But the Abrams campaign asserts that there remain about 100,000 votes that have not been counted. If 25,000 of those votes go for Abrams, they're in runoff territory. Those votes are overwhelmingly in the North Atlanta suburbs, which are exactly the kinds of places that Larry and Nancy just described. They're places that used to be Republican country, but that are now, due to demographic change, much more competitive for Democrats. They're places where we were watching all day yesterday, huge problems with voting. They had a court ordered Gwinnett County to stay open till 10 o'clock because so many people weren't able to vote. Those are the votes that were now waiting to be counted, and a lot of the mail-in votes. This could actually get quite ugly because if the Secretary of State's office decides that those votes should not be counted for one reason or another, the Abrams campaign went into this by building one of the most ambitious, unprecedented legal teams prepared to have a voting rights fight. So they are very much prepared to go to court over this.
It may be frustrating to young people in a hurry, but you don't always measure progress by winning.
Yeah.
The fact that Gillum came so close, and I don't think there are enough votes out there for him to flip it, but coming that close in a state like Florida, coming that close in a state like Georgia for black statewide candidates represents real progress. It's something for Democrats, progressives, people who are looking to get more diversity among public officials. It really is something to build on.
So I'm going to put an asterisk next to my question. I come back to you.
Debbie semi-down.
Debbie semi-down.
But it's true that they did not. I think Democrats were hoping to flip more state, setting race to the side, were hoping to win more governorships than they did, you know, and that is going to have long-term effects. But Larry is absolutely right. The question is, no matter the outcome of these places, they have changed those parties. They've built a party infrastructure, certainly in Georgia.
Absolutely.
Stacey Abrams' campaign, win or lose, she has fundamentally changed Georgia politics. And so we'll see what that means.
And a little more from Larry Upper, which is not the role I normally play. But you also have to take a page from the Republicans' long-term plan from almost a generation ago and look at what happened last night. On Long Island, for instance, it was status quo for the congressional seats, but Democrats went to the polls with 7 Republicans and 2 Democrats as state senators, and they woke up with 6 Democrats and 3 Republicans as state senators. So there were a lot of state legislative races around the country that went to Democrats. There were gubernatorial races, other than the ones we discussed, that went to Democrats. And these are the people who will redraw the congressional lines of the districts we've been talking about and make them even more competitive, or even in some cases, depending upon how the census turns out, leaning Democrat.
Larry, I have a question for you.
Sure.
What do you make of the Pete King race and the fact that he, the Republican in that suburban Long Island district, was able to survive in the and compared to Rodney Frelinghuysen,
sure,
Leonard Lance, that those Republicans weren't able to survive?
That was one of your predictions last week, Larry.
Exactly. Yeah, and you know, they're I mean, we can argue, was it a blue current? Was it a blue wave? We know it wasn't a tsunami. On Long Island, I think it's easy to argue that there was a blue wave just based on the Senate seats flipping. But, you know, as I think I said last week, my takeaway line was, if all politics is local, it's also personal. And Peter King had been there for more than a generation. And there are old-time Democrats who remember that he voted against Bill Clinton's impeachment, that he voted for some pro-labor stuff, whose details escape me now, that he was their go-to guy, Democratic local officials, their go-to guy after 9/11 and after Hurricane Sandy. None of them were really lifting much of a finger to help his opponent. She ran a remarkable campaign for a first-timer, raised more money than anybody expected, but it would have had to have been a historic tsunami for Peter King to have been washed out to political sea. So this was an exception to the rule, and we have those exceptions all over the country. Lee Zeldin is not in a traditionally suburban district. I know because it's on Long Island, people say that, but it's more like the ones that Nancy described. They are ex-urban, leaning to rural, the kind of places where Trump actually did well in his primary and in the general election. So Zeldin made a decision that he was going to, unlike many, many suburban Republicans, tie himself tightly to Trump, and it worked.
I love that we are just running with the maritime metaphor. I'm talking to Kai Wright from WNYC's podcast, United States of Anxiety, Nancy Solomon, who's the managing editor of New Jersey Public Radio, and Larry Levy, executive director of the National Center for Suburban Studies at Hofstra. Nancy, we're going to give you props as well. You predicted that Senator Bob Menendez would retain his seat, no problem. Why did that happen?
When the signs started popping up in my Maplewood neighborhood, which is something like 85 to 90% Democratic, when the signs started popping up a week ago that said, "Stop Trump, vote for Menendez," I thought, oh yeah, that's going to help him. And I think that he has Donald Trump to thank. Democrats in New Jersey were not going to send a Republican to the Senate, and they held their nose. And I talked to many voters yesterday, and they pretty much said that. So I think it was two things. It was that, and it was, the Democratic Party machines in New Jersey are alive and well, and they closed ranks behind Menendez a year ago after his corruption trial. There was no primary challenge to him to speak of. A woman who was completely unknown in New Jersey politics ran against him and got 38% of the vote, which is huge for someone who's nobody knew who she was. And they got the vote out for him, and then the activists started campaigning for him in the last few weeks too, the same activists who are working on those midterm congressional House seats.
Did I ever tell you my mother taught at Columbia High School for 30 years?
You did not.
There you go. Just had to throw that in. A little Jersey love.
Kai. I was going to apologize for interrupting, but I'm not so sure I should apologize. one more thing about Menendez. There's a question that Democrats are talking about. And I had several conversations this morning. These are national Democrats. That, he survived. He won by the enrollment pretty much in New Jersey. But the fact that he decided to run when a half a dozen other Democrats could have beaten Hugin without making, having to spend $20 million. Did the resources that Chuck Schumer and Democrats have to put into that race take money away from other races that they might have won elsewhere in the country? I think that's a question that people are starting to talk about.
Yeah. I want to pick up something that Nancy said, and I want to ask it to Kai. You talked about people holding their nose and voting for Menendez. Kai, how much do you think, with these sort of moderate Democrats, that there were people last time, perhaps conservative Democrats or liberal Republicans, who held their nose and voted for Trump or didn't vote, who came out this time?
I don't know. I mean, I am not sure I have ever bought the held my nose and voted for Trump idea in the first instance. I think that Donald Trump was very clear about who he was. He ran a very clear and focused campaign, actually, on his message. And I think the people who voted for him supported what he had to say. And I think that we have done a lot of intellectual and emotional black flips to try to not acknowledge as a country that that many people agree with that kind of message. So that's one thing.
I know a couple from like Westport, Connecticut types who were just like, he's not going to do all that stuff he says. Not that group.
You know who told themselves that or who had such profound dislike for Hillary Clinton. But I don't know that you can separate those two ideas, support for what he had to say and their profound dislike for Hillary Clinton. So that's why I just always challenge that premise in the first place. But then also, you know, I mean, I think it's what it feels like in this election is much more about people who changed their relationships to politics, period. And this was a lot of Nancy's reporting in New Jersey, you know, that we were doing in the United States of Anxiety, you know, just women in particular who had a much more passive relationship to politics and to political power, who may have been voters, you know, so it's not just whether I do or don't vote and what party I do or don't vote for, but weren't activists, people who went from not voting to voters, but very importantly, people who went from just being voters to being activists, that then created all kinds of new voters, you know. And so Nancy covered that throughout New Jersey. I've seen a lot of that in Georgia amongst black women and part of the Stacey Abrams campaign. We reported on hearing about that in Montana with the support for Kathleen Williams' campaign. So I think as you look around the country, I think what we really saw was just people who just saw politics differently and saw their personal stake in it differently. Mm-hmm. And that led them to a more intensified engagement that then led to put things in play that weren't in play before.
Now, as we've been speaking, the president's been having a press conference in which he's been congratulating Republicans on their victories in the midterms and taking ownership of some of those wins. The president also went after candidates who distanced themselves from him during the campaign. So let's take a listen.
For the most part, I didn't campaign for the House, but I did actually make a special trip for Andy Barr because he was in a very tough race in Kentucky, and he won. That was a very tough race. The polls were all showing that he was down and down substantially, and he won. And that one I did do. Pete Stauber of Minnesota, great guy. He's new and ran a fantastic race. On the other hand, you had some that decided to, let's stay away. They did very poorly. I'm not sure that I should be happy or sad, but I feel just fine about it. Carlos Cubella, Mike Kaufman. Too bad, Mike. Mia Love. I saw Mia Love. She'd call me all the time to help her with a hostage situation. Being held hostage in Venezuela, but Mia Love gave me no love, and she lost. Too bad. Sorry about that, Mia. And Barbara Comstock was another one. I mean, I think she could have won that race, but she didn't want to have any embrace. For that, I don't blame her. But she lost, substantially lost. Peter Roskam, didn't want the embrace. Eric Paulson didn't want the embrace. And in New Jersey, I think he could have done well, but it didn't work out too good. Bob Eugen, I feel badly because I think that's something that could have been won. That's a race that could have been won. John Faso, those are some of the people that, you know, decided for their own reason not to embrace whether it's me or what we stand for.
We have a new Trumpism, the embrace.
Well, you know, I can give you the examples just in New Jersey that would contradict President Trump. He had an almost total embrace of Jay Weber in the 11th, who got pummeled. He embraced Bob Hugin, and Bob Hugin embraced him back. And Bob Hugin lost to Menendez, who was a wounded, injured candidate. And Seth Grossman embraced the president and lost. Tom MacArthur's fighting for his political life after embracing the president. And John McCain in the 5th District up in Bergen County had a full embrace and lost. So, you know, he's, of course, we knew that he was going to try to turn this and blame others and say that the country still loves him and this is his victory and their loss. And I think that's what he's doing.
And you can go right the way around the country. I mean, the list is long of candidates he embraced who lost and lost badly. But I think also pitching forward is something to take from this moment. You know, there's been some reporting that that there was a lot of effort from Republican strategists, the Paul Ryan amongst them, to try to get him to, you know, shut up about immigration and the run up here and their strat. And they said, oh, you know, you should. They convinced him to make it about himself, and that's how they got him to be closer to a message they wanted. Was, oh, just make it about yourself, and leaned into his narcissism, and I think that. And so we began to see that on the campaign trail, and we've seen that in his presidency. But I think the next 2 years, what you are hearing right now, that is the get ready for a great deal of that. It is going to be Donald Trump versus the world.
Well, at least we substituted embrace for grab.
Fair enough.
Okay, we're ending there. Kai, Nancy, and Larry, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Hope you all will come back.
Thanks, thank you, Allison.
Coming up next on All of It, a musical set in Duluth, Minnesota, set entirely to the music of Bob Dylan. We'll get into it next. I'm Allison Stewart. All of It will be back after a short break. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. A new musical, Girl from the North Country, transformed Bob Dylan's songbook into a lovely but tragic story about families in crisis, set in a boarding house in 1934 in Minnesota, Dylan's home state. The show weaves together Dylan's poetic songwriting with a haunting script about crumbling lives after the Great Depression. Take a listen to this moment when one of the characters realizes his true love is leaving him for a better prospect. The song is I Want You from Dylan's Blonde on Blonde album.
Guilty undertaker sighs, the lonesome organ grinder cries, the silver saxophone says I should refuse you, the cracked bells and the washed out horns blow into my face with scorn, but it's not that way, I wasn't born to lose you. I want you, I want you.
Following a critically acclaimed sold-out run in London, Girl from the North Country is now at the Public Theater through December 23rd. It was written and directed by Tony Award nominee Connie McPherson, who Ben Brantley of the New York Times named one of the greatest playwrights working today. The show has gotten rave reviews, even moving Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar to tweet, "We're always proud that Bob Dylan grew up in Minnesota. New York debut of Bob Dylan musical Girl from North Country gets rave review." Three of the show's actors are here. Jeanette Bayardell. Hi, Jeanette.
Hello.
Kimber Sproul. Hi, Kimber.
Hi.
And Todd Altman are in studio. Hi, Todd.
Hello.
So I want you all, if you wouldn't mind, giving a little bit of a synopsis or describe your character. Kimber, your character is pregnant.
Yes.
She
is...
Doesn't want to be where she is.
She doesn't want to be where she is. She's a... she's pregnant, and she's also adopted by the family, a white family, and... she's in a place now where she doesn't want to be defined by her pregnancy by any means. She also doesn't want to be defined by her environment. And I feel like everyone wants to take care of her because she's a woman and she's Black in 1934. But she never asked for that help. She's very independent. She's very witty and strong-minded. So she also is very quiet. So she waits until the opportunity to seize the things that she wants.
Her father desperately is trying to marry her off to
she is
an old dude.
She's engaged to a very old man. And again, it's that idea that women can't do anything on their own, especially when they're pregnant. And her, you know, her dad is trying to do what he thinks is best, but no one ever asked what she wanted.
What does she want? Creating her character, what did you decide she wanted?
She wants freedom. She wants liberation. And she wants to define herself on her own terms.
Jeanette, you play Mrs. Nielsen.
Yes.
She's a widow. Why is she at the boarding house?
She's at the boarding house because she is, her husband passed away and he was in the railroad business, and she's expecting money. There's money for her there. So she's trying to get this money. So she's, you know, seeing attorneys and just trying to get this money, and that's why she's there. So she has this hope of getting this money and helping Nick Lane, who is the owner of the boarding house, help fix his life with his money problems because he's losing the boarding house. And hopefully trying to have a better life with him. Although it's really not, probably not going to happen, and it, I don't want to say what happens, but because of the situation. But she's very hopeful, and I feel like she tries to be like the healer in the house, and she has relationship with everyone in the house, and she tries to be the arms and the hands of Nick because he's not that much, he's not emotionally available for everyone. She tries to be that for him in the house.
I don't want to call it saying she's having an affair because Nick's wife is incapacitated.
Right.
They're having a relationship, and I think there's a little bit of a difference there.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe their relationship?
It's so weird because she has so much love for his wife, who has issues and pretty much not here because she has early onset dementia.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like she feels like she's caught in a conundrum because here she is, you know, loving to this wife, and she cares about her and she's helping her, but at the same time she's in love with her husband. And although they're not divorced, you know, and he is still committed to making sure that Elizabeth, his wife, is safe. And, you know, so it's a hard place to be in because he's committed. It makes her, even Mrs. Nielsen, even more committed to taking care of this woman who is his wife, who has early onset dementia. So it's kind of complicated, but I feel like people kind of understand it, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, Todd, you play Elias Burke. He's a mentally impaired son of a very snazzy-looking couple, very well-dressed, even though they've lost all their money.
Yes.
And your role requires a lot of, I think, delicacy and also a lot of physical expression so that we understand Elias.
Mm-hmm.
How did you prepare for this, and what kind of decisions did you and the director make?
Well, Connor, who wrote and directed, was really great in letting us explore our characters on our own. They did the show in London with a different cast, but he never really insisted that we do anything in a certain way. So in terms of developing my character, I don't say a lot. I have two lines in the piece. I spend so much time with my parents who are maybe on the run, who have lost their business, who had a lot of money, you can tell by the clothes they wear, but it's all fallen apart around them. A lot of it was just having such a great interaction with Mark Kudish and Luba Mason, who play my parents. Like, they're both such available actors, and we just developed this physical relationship with each other. And I realized early on, oh, my character is really an important foil to Mark's character, who has a big, a really exciting journey in the play, I think, that I won't spoil. But I felt like my character was there to help facilitate that and to kind of be a catalyst to his big change or big moment, whatever you want to call it. So to that end, I thought it would be really fun to just kind of always be on him physically. So when you watch the show, I'm always like touching him
and also,
or like wrestling him. And I'm huge. Yes.
How tall are you?
I'm 6'6".
Oh,
yeah. Yes.
That's the other part of this childlike.
Yes.
a childlike child.
Yes.
Grown child.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was really interesting to me to watch that.
He describes me in one, the text describes me at one point as a creature who doesn't know his own strengths and longings. And I just took that to heart.
I know, I felt so Mice and Men.
It has that quality. Yeah, definitely.
But then you get to bust out a song.
Oh my God. In a big way.
In a big, big way.
Yes.
First of all, what did you think when you heard that you got to have this big splashy number?
I lost my mind. I mean, Jeanette and I both did the reading of the piece in the spring, and when I got the script and I was reading it, I go, okay, this is really interesting, and then I heard the song and I went, oh my God. I feel like I struck gold that I get to do this. And it was, I felt so lucky.
And when we heard him sing the song, we were like, this is gold.
I felt so lucky. I'm really thrilled.
It was amazing.
Yeah, it's a beautiful number.
We're speaking with Jeanette Bayardell, Todd Allman, and Kimber Sprawl. They are starring in Girl from the North Country. So let's talk a little bit about the transformation of Bob Dylan's music in all of this. I mean, it's, how do you describe it, Kimber, when you describe it to people?
His music, well, To start, I was never really a Bob Dylan fan. I didn't grow up listening to him. It wasn't in our house. And honestly, even when I was cast, I was like, I'm not really sure about this guy. But Connor and Simon, who wrote the who arranged the music, they were just able to take Bob's lyrics to just a different level. I think it's just transforming what they did. And so in that respect, you really hear his message. I think Bob was really good at seeing things in society. A lot of it was in the 60s, and he wasn't afraid to speak about it, to really speak about humanity and truth in our society. And when paired with these arrangements, it's illuminating. It really is.
How do you explain it to people, Jeanette?
It's Bob Dylan. The music is very soulful, and it makes sense. It makes sense that it's soulful, but Simon Hale, who was the arranger along with Connor, they did a good job. I mean, so many people come to the show and they're like, I've never heard music like this.
Yeah.
The sound, the voices, they think that we're not singing. Mm-hmm, it sounds like a recording. Mm-hmm. And it is pretty amazing to hear what they've done with the songs. And so, some of the arrangements, I was thinking the other day while we were on stage, I'm like, wow, this is amazing. Like, what was Simon thinking when he was creating
this? The first time, this is a story that has been told to me and to someone else, so I'm going to try to get it right, but the first time that Bob Dylan actually listened to Tight Connection, he sat there, the song finished, and he sat back and he said, huh. And then everyone's like, huh, what does that mean? And when Bob says something like that, he's just like, I never thought about it that way. I didn't know that my music could be this, you know? Mm-hmm. And really Tight Connection is already such an amazing song, but I think Simon and Connor elevated the music and elevated the lyrics to another just spectacular level.
They managed to make it, like the show is in 1934.
Yeah.
But the music is both that direction, but also completely anachronistic, because mm-hmm. there'll be like a rock and roll beat, which is not what the period would have been. So mm-hmm. they've created this unique language that is specific to this show.
Right.
And it just, it elevates and illuminates in this way that is beyond, like, let's place it in a certain time. It just feels eternal or something.
Yeah, and that's why they did it. When I explain the show, I'm like, it's not your traditional jukebox or review type of musical. Mm-hmm. Because of the complex and the rich story that we have, it complements it very well, but it's also like a commentary on society today and a commentary of the 60s. And we also have the 1934 commentary, and you see that it's just a revolving door of humanity and how we continue to learn the same lessons over and over again.
There's a brilliant moment. I was just thinking of it yesterday and talking about a friend in your scene, Kimber, with Sydney, where you say something about bad times, and he says it's always bad times. And I thought, oh, that is the most genius way of describing this piece. It's always bad times, and there's all this humanity inside of it.
And go ahead.
I was going to say that the music, like Kimber saying, it acts as a soundtrack to a beautiful painting that comes to life. And I also feel like Dylan's, what we've done with Dylan's music is kind of, it opens up the ears of those who were not able to hear it from Dylan singing it or from that time period, it's bringing it to a new generation, and it's like your ears are brand new and you're like, oh wow, who is this guy? Who is Bob Dylan?
Well, he was before his time in a lot of ways, and we break the fourth wall a lot. There are moments where we just sing out to the audience, and I always imagine that we're putting that mirror up, you know, to them so that they can reflect on the past and the future and where we are now and where we could be going and where we came from. And Bob really was able to just zero in on that. And when you're just sitting back and you have this amazing story that Connor wrote that just complements it in such an amazing way and makes you think, Connor never gives you anything. You know, the play doesn't have this definitive beginning, middle, or ending, honestly. It's all up for interpretation.
We had someone in one of our talkbacks, and he said, this musical is a Bob Dylan song.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he said, what Connor McPherson created is a Bob Dylan song, which is perfect because it has Bob Dylan music.
Yeah.
And we were like, wow, that's deep.
Well, you know what? I want people to experience a little bit of it. Let's play a little bit. It's you two ladies singing. Let's roll that.
Okay. There's a woman on my
We're with Jeanette Bardell, Todd Allman, and Kimberly Sprawl. You heard them there, and Girl from the North Country. There is some pretty amazing tambourine work in the show.
Yeah, it is.
It's really interesting, the staging of it. You all are the percussion section quite often. What do you enjoy about that part of it, Todd? The part where you guys are on stage, even through your smallest movements, even through shakers and tambourines, it really sort of saturates.
And it feels like there's this infectious thing that takes over both us on stage and the audience. I mean, Kimber, you had such a beautiful image of holding up a mirror to the audience, and it feels that way too. There's a moment in the show where we're all just kind of moving our feet in this particular way while Mare is singing, and then the girls start playing the percussion. It just feels like we all caught something. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that goes out to the audience. And a brilliant thing that Connor really pushed for, and I don't know if we should even, maybe I shouldn't talk about this, but we don't want applause.
Oh, tell me.
Well, we don't want applause. Okay. So we never want to break the spell. So we've engineered it, and we try really hard to make sure nobody claps for until the very end of the act
the
one and then of the piece.
Right.
So it does feel like there's this kind of spell that takes over, and it does manifest when everyone starts playing instruments. We're like crickets or something, you know, like we all just start making all this noise together. It's really exciting. That's
it. When you're on stage and you have the tambourine and you're in charge of the percussion,
I feel like it's a spiritual moment and like a religious moment. And I grew up in the church, so you know, when I got the tambourine, I'm like, oh, I got this, you know. I've been playing tambourine for years. Playing tambourine in a musical is not that easy, because you cannot play your own thing.
It's more structured,
you know,
right?
And what's beautiful about this music is a lot of us, like Todd, had to learn the harmonica, and Luba Mason playing the drums, and Mark Kudish, they learned to play these instruments for this show. So this is something that people come in, they're like, oh yeah, I know, they were drummers, right? I'm like, no. They had to learn to play that, and I had to learn to play my tambourine as well. But it's such a spiritual moment, I feel.
Yeah.
And Kimber, I'll give you the last word.
All of that, but also stressful. You know, it's a lot of work to maintain that rhythm, and it's so intimate to the point where you hear everything. So if that tambourine is off, everyone looks like they know that it was you. So I love the responsibility, but I'm also stressed.
Live theater, babe.
Yeah, that's it.
Kimber Sprawl, Jeanette Bardell, and Todd Allman. They're starring in Girl from North Country. Thank you guys for coming into the studio.
Hey,
we really do
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up next in All of It, the journalist and writer to watch, listen to, and follow up for all things Silicon Valley, Kara Swisher. She joins us next on All of It. Don't go away. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Welcome back. Yesterday, if you were online at all, you likely saw one or more tech companies urging you to vote. Google changed its logo to say go vote, and Facebook pinned a message to the top of its news feed and urged you to show your friends that you voted. But what effect have big tech companies had on our election? What kind of information people have been receiving around the election? Few people cover tech as aggressively and pointedly as my next guest, Kara Swisher. She's the executive editor of Recode, host and co-executive producer of Recode Decode podcast, and contributing opinion columnist for the New York Times. Kara, welcome back.
Thank you very much. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Now, of all the contests yesterday, which will have the biggest results, biggest impact, I should say, on tech?
Of all the contests?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it'll be interesting to see the House in control of the Democrats, because they've got quite a few bills that they're thinking around privacy, around regulation of tech. I'm not sure it'll work without the Senate involved, and so it's probably good for tech because there'll be gridlock, but eventually some level of regulation for tech going on.
In California, Prop C passed, and it'll charge corporations revenue above $50 million with like a 0.5% gross receipts tax, I believe it is. San Francisco Chronicle piece said that tech leaders were too silent on this. Where do tech firms stand on this?
Well, not everybody. Tech firms were against it because they live in the city, and some were. Mark Benioff was the most vocal for it and gave a lot of money for it. He runs Salesforce, which is the biggest employer in San Francisco, tech employer in San Francisco, and the biggest employer. So they were mixed on it, but I think the question is how to deal with homelessness, I think, is a big debate, and what the best way to do it and where the best money should come from. But I don't think anyone in San Francisco is against taxing businesses. So it went through.
We should point out, yes, thank you for filling that in, that the money was supposed to go towards homeless programs. So I'm curious about this. Late Monday night, Facebook had announced that it identified dozens of accounts on Instagram that were maybe possibly engaged in what they called inauthentic behavior. So far, the company says it's blocked around 30 Facebook accounts, mostly French and Russian, 85 Instagram accounts. Two-point question. Why did that take so long to do that? And two, do you think the sort of cleaning up of social media in the last 2 years had an impact on the midterms?
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that. There was so much news on this in general, it sort of overwhelmed everything. I think the question is, how can they continue to sort of put the systems in place and remove fake accounts, remove bots? That's a huge problem, these bots that swarm on news stories. And actually bring transparency to political advertising. I think if they can start to do those things, it'll make a big difference. But I think one of the things that it's shown is they just don't have control of this. And it's going to be like dealing with cockroaches all the time, like almost all the time. And so they've got to have a real plan in place to deal with an ongoing series of things, not just here in this country, but globally.
You wrote a really great New York Times column, really interesting, and you talk about that you had in your career an anti-Semite who would write you letters, like hardcore letters, back when you were at the Washington Post. Can you tell people what those letters used to say?
Well, they were anti-Semitic. What would happen, I wrote about retail, and there were some names that this guy considered Jewish, I guess. And so he would write me, he would tear out my article, and then he'd write in tiny little red pen, scrawl all these anti-Semitic things on the article, and then send it to me. And my point was that it would only be sent to me. And what was happening with the bombing in Pittsburgh, or with the pipe bombs that went to CNN and some Democratic leaders, is these people were online spewing this bile to everybody. And so my point was, as I'm making many times, is that social media allows these vile people to amplify and weaponize their messages almost continually. And the question is, how can we figure out who's just being vile and who is actually dangerous? But they certainly have platforms they never could before, compared to this guy that just mailed me a letter when I was at the Washington Post.
For you personally, does it feel more threatening now than it did then?
No, I mean, it was awful to receive those letters. It's really sad to look at a really demented part of the human race that is racist or anti-Semitic. Yeah, I think it's scary for humanity. I'm not so sure it's scary for Kara Swisher, but I think, you know, when you see those things and when you see, but, you know, right now there's a press conference going on where the president is attacking the media right now, like right now as we speak. And so it's part of the coarsening of our culture. And obviously President Trump leads the way on Twitter doing that. It's the ability just to say anything you want at any time you want without any civility. And I think that the question is, can we put that civility back in the box? It doesn't seem so just from at today's news conference and what everything is on Twitter and all social media. So the question is, what do we do about that? And that's a very big question, I think, for our society.
You know, a lot of people think, oh, it's just online. It's somebody tweeting, somebody who's angry. But then, of course, we see Robert Bowers, who mm-hmm. was charged in the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting, and he used a different yeah. social media platform. He used Gab. What's Gab?
Mm-hmm. Well, it has a cute name, doesn't it? It sounds like it should be for teens, like Gab in a way, but mm-hmm. it's actually their premise is that a platform to say whatever you want, and it's turned into an alt-right platform is what it has. And because a lot of these people have been kicked off or pushed down on things like Reddit or Facebook or Twitter. And so this is a platform that they're able to say what they want, and what they want to say is just terrible. And so he was on that platform, and they just spew venom back and forth. And so he was able to use it. Now, some internet companies that were servicing Gab, you know, dumped them some of their internet service providers and things like that, and the people that were doing payments and things like that. But they find homes. These things always find. You know, cesspools always find their level, and that's what Gab is. And so there's going to be more and more of those as people get pushed down and pushed off of the mainstream platform.
Yeah, it's a little bit creepy when you log on to it. I didn't log all the way onto it because I just didn't want to deal with that. Yeah. But it's, you know, it's like this yeah. cute little green logo, and they have their verticals, yeah. and mm-hmm. you click on here, it's music and, you know, politics and funny, and most of the funny stuff is really unfunny. It was a very strange experience to sort of just put my toe in the water in that.
Yep. Yeah. Don't take your toe out. It's gonna be infected. It's an infectious cesspool. That it's sad that it exists, but you know, here we are.
So Sam Biddle at The Intercept reported that just days mm-hmm. after the Pittsburgh shooting, you could still buy ads on Facebook with targeting a category of white genocide conspiracy mm-hmm. theory. What responsibility does Facebook have at this point to regulate ads?
You know, I would imagine, yeah, well, I don't know. I don't, you know, I think, why would you want those ads on your platform? You know, New York Times doesn't have those, you know, CBS News doesn't have those. I mean, it's beyond me that you're able to do this. It's because it's an automated system and they can't control every terrible thing people are going to do. But, you know, they may want to try to think hard about who they want on their system and who they want to appear. And the ability to target anyone means you could do that to almost anything. And so, they have to figure out ways, either algorithmically or using humans, to clean the place up, because I don't think it does them any favors to have this either.
You also wrote, when I first saw the internet way back when, I hoped that it would eliminate the attitudes that had fueled those horrible letters to me. Why hasn't that happened? What's in the way of that happening?
Humanity. What to say? You know, humanity with these tools. This is an experiment in human communication.
Oh, interesting.
As there has never been. All of humanity is now able to talk to each other. And unfortunately, we're falling down on that job of doing something. You know, you think it would be Star Trek, and it's turned out to be something quite darker. And so the question is, the leaders of these companies, if they can clean them up or push people towards community. There are all kinds of studies that if you facilitate something for virality, for speed, and for engagement, you're going to get this. What if they did it towards accuracy, context, community? They can make pillars like that of their services, and they just aren't, because virality and speed works, because it sells ads, because it creates growth. And so that's the big question is, do we want this? Or because this is what's going to happen if it continues, and not just here, all over the planet, and sometimes with very dire results, as in India or Myanmar.
It's really interesting. I remember last time I spoke to you, you said that you thought that the tech titans all should have taken more humanities courses and read more books.
Yeah, exactly.
And we really didn't get a chance to follow up with that, and I was really interested in that comment.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a little Kierkegaard might be good for them. I don't know what to say. Like a little bit of like Shakespeare, Socrates, all kinds of things. You know, wide reading. Read a little Maya Angelou poetry. Like, you know, it's just that, you know, they take everything is so mathematical. And it's some of these issues are highly ethical issues. And you need to have some sort of grounding in the ability to understand humanity, because it's not just numbers. These are people. And people aren't so easily fit into data and fit into numbers. And I think it's really important that these leaders who are leading some of the biggest communications platforms in history understand how people behave and understand what to do about it. Bring in some philosophers, bring in some all kinds of people to understand this and figure out solutions to it. Because if done right, it's a wonderful thing. If done wrong, welcome to the internet, you know, kind of thing.
And speaking of tech leaders, you had Elon Musk on your podcast, and mm-hmm. I heard him say it reminded you of the Elon Musk that you have known over the years, that mm-hmm. he sort of has come back around. What do you think's next for him?
Well, you know, we talked about for 90 minutes almost, and so we talked about a wide range of things, from Tesla to SpaceX, his rockets. We talked about his boring company digging tunnels under Los Angeles right now to alleviate traffic. You know, he wants to go to Mars. He's putting up astronauts. So a lot of things are next for him. He's quite an active guy. And what's interesting, you know, he's had a really bad year, and he indulged himself in some really ridiculous behavior, especially on Twitter. Again, mm-hmm. addicted to Twitter, and he behaves badly. You know what I mean? Like, here's a person who could really change the world, and instead he's trading ridiculous barbs with reporters online. It's kind of a waste of his energy and intellect. But he talked about that and his exhaustion. I think a lot of it was due to exhaustion and his hard work. But, you know, he's doing a lot of cool things. There's so many things in it. I'd recommend you listen to it because it's
absolutely
very, it's an interesting insight into someone who is actually working on stuff that's really significant as far as I'm concerned.
It was a great listen, and you should check it out. Kara Swisher from Recode Decode. Always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for making time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.